5 ounces of their vinegary oxymele concoction and some syrup of citron rind to ameliorate its bitter taste. Now that Cestilia had assumed the domestic care of Vincenzo through her wedding vows and also tended lovingly to many of Galileo's personal needs, Suor Maria Celeste apparently found another way to aid her father. One of her letters suggests that she busied herself recopying his draft manuscript of the dialogue. Sections Galileo had composed at different times in different formats now needed to be handwritten page by page in perfect penmanship for publication, with corrections and additions pasted in as necessary. When Suor Maria Celeste referred to ritagli, or clippings, already in her possession during November of 1629, reminding him of additional ones he had promised to send before she could set to work on the whole lot, she more than likely meant pieces of the dialogue that reached her piecemeal. The book's original manuscript has not survived, however, nor any description of it that notes whose handwriting it bore. On the short fourth and final day of the dialogue, Galileo rehashed the treatise on the tides he had given to Cardinal Orsini in 1616, in which he judged the flux and reflux of the sea to be the inevitable result of the Earth's two motions, one around its own axis, the other around the sun. As the Earth turns, its daily spinning conspires with its annual revolution to jar the great oceans. Not only can the moving earth account for the tides, Salviati indicates in his speeches, but also the tides, by their very existence, reveal the motion of the earth. After Simplicio denounces this idea as fictitious, the men continue to plumb the confounding complexity of the tides, how they vary in timing, in volume, and in height from one part of the world to another. Salviati suggests that the effort of accounting for these anomalies in the Mediterranean alone led literally to the death of Aristotle. Some say it was because of these differences and the incomprehensibility of their causes to Aristotle that he, after observing them for a long time from some cliffs of Euboea, plunged into the sea in a fit of despair and willfully destroyed himself. The denouement at that day's end, when it came time for the three characters to close discussion and draw conclusions, demanded delicate diplomacy, for the text of the third and fourth days advanced compelling physical arguments in support of Copernicus, while the overall tenor of the book needed to preserve the spirit of hypothesis, as Galileo had promised Urban it would. In the conversations of these 4 days, we have, then, strong evidences in favor of the Copernican system, sums up the hospitable Sagredo, among which 3 have been shown to be very convincing, those taken from the stoppings and retrograde motions of the planets and their approaches toward and recessions from the earth, 2nd, from the revolution of the sun upon itself, and from what is to be observed in the sunspots, and 3rd, from the ebbing and flowing of the ocean tides. But Salviati cum Galileo, although he has led the discussion in this direction, refuses to endorse Copernicus in the end. He concedes that this invention, meaning the heliocentric design, may very easily turn out to be a most foolish hallucination and a majestic paradox. By such equivocation, Galileo offset his persuasive, often passionate defense of Copernicus. At the end of the dialogue, he further sought to please Pope Urban by complying with his Beatitude's wish to see a reprise of the cicada philosophy from the Assayer, the idea that God and nature possess boundless means for creating the effects observed by men. But Galileo placed these words in the mouth of Simplicio, where their profundity rang shallow. As to the discourses we have held, and especially this last one concerning the reasons for the ebbing and flowing of the ocean, I am really not entirely convinced, balks the staunch Aristotelian. But from such feeble ideas of the matter as I have formed, I admit that your thoughts seem to me more ingenious than many others I have heard. I do not therefore consider them true and conclusive. Indeed, keeping always before my mind's eye a most solid doctrine that I once heard from a most eminent and learned person, and before which one must fall silent, I know that if asked whether God, in his infinite power and wisdom, could have conferred upon the watery element its observed reciprocating motion using some other means than moving its containing vessels, both of you would reply that he could have, and that he would have known how to do this in many ways which are unthinkable to our minds. From this I forthwith conclude that, this being so, it would be excessive boldness for anyone to limit and restrict the divine power and wisdom to some particular fancy of his own. And so they part company, hopeful of another fruitful convention on other fascinating themes at some future date. As he neared completion of his dialogue, Galileo anticipated submitting the final text for censorship. Not just sensitive subjects, such as the structure of the universe, but all books on any topics, fell under this directive throughout Catholic Europe, following a papal bull issued in 1515 by the Medici Pope Leo X. Writers seeking publication, this decree stated, must have their manuscripts scrutinized by a bishop of the church or bishop's appointees, as well as by the local inquisitor. Printers who started their presses without the requisite permissions faced excommunication, fines, and the burning of their books. For the special case of Germany, fount of the Reformation, Pope Leo perforce prepared another bull 5 years later in 1520, prohibiting all works, past and future, from the pen of Martin Luther. The Roman Inquisition, after its reorganization in 1542, assumed supervision of printing projects in Italy, and in 1559 promulgated the first worldwide Index of Prohibited Books. In 1564, following the Council of Trent, harsher new restrictions stipulated that authors, as well as printers, could be excommunicated for publishing works judged heretical. Even the readers of such texts could be so punished. Booksellers, likewise, had to beware keeping an exact listing of their stock and standing ever ready for impromptu inspections called by bishops or inquisitors. All of Galileo's previously published works had undergone the requisite scrutiny, for Italian printers obeyed the rules more strictly than most, especially in Rome, home of the Holy Office of the Inquisition. The Starry Messenger, printed in Venice, carried the approbation of the heads of the Venetian law enforcement agency called the Council of Ten, as well as the resident Most Reverend Father Inquisitor, the overseers of Padua University, and the secretary of the Venetian Senate, all of whom swore that in the book entitled Sidereus Nuncius by Galileo Galilei, there is nothing contrary to the Holy Catholic faith, principles, or good customs, and that it is worthy of being printed. When Prince Cesi was preparing to print the sunspot letters in Rome, he discussed with Cardinal Bellarmino the potential problem of impugning the sun's incorruptibility, while Galileo double-checked this point with Cardinal Conti. Neither eminence thought the sunspots would disturb the censors, and in fact, the book was licensed without incident. The assayer, too, had negotiated official channels smoothly. But Galileo suspected the substance of the dialogue might give the censors serious cause for concern. Most beloved Lord Father, now that the tempest of our many torments has subsided somewhat, I want to make you fully aware of the events, Sire, without leaving anything out, for in so doing I hope to ease my mind and at the same time to be excused by you for dashing off my last two letters so randomly instead of writing in the proper manner. For truly I was half beside myself, shaken by the terror aroused in me and in all of us by our novice mistress, who, overpowered by those moods or frenzies of hers, tried twice in recent days to kill herself. The first time she struck her head and face against the ground with such force that she became monstrously deformed. The second night she stabbed herself 13 times, leaving 2 wounds in her throat, 2 in her stomach, and the others in her abdomen. I leave you to imagine, Sire, the horror that gripped us when we found her body all bloody and battered. But we were even more stupefied at how, as seriously injured as she was, she made the noise that drew us to enter her cell, asked for the confessor, and then, in confession, handed over to the priest the instrument she had used, so as to prevent any of us from seeing it, although, as far as we can conjecture, it was a pocket knife. Thus it appears that she was crazy and cunning at the same time, and the only possible conclusion is that these are mysterious judgments of the Lord, who still keeps her alive, when, for every natural cause, she should surely have died, as the wounds were all perilous ones, according to the surgeon. In the wake of these events, we have guarded her continuously day and night. Now that the rest of us are recovered, by the grace of blessed God, and she is tied in her bed, albeit with the same deliriums, we continue to live in fear of some new outburst. Beyond this travail of ours, I want to apprise you of another anxiety that has been weighing heavily on my heart. The very moment you were so kind as to send me the 20 scudi I had requested, I did not dare to speak freely of this in person when you asked me recently if I had obtained the cell yet. I went with the money in my hand to find the nun who was selling it, expecting that she, being in extreme necessity, would willingly accept that money, but she simply could not resign herself to relinquishing the cell she loved so much. And since we did not reach an agreement between ourselves, nothing came of it, and I lost the chance to purchase that little room. Having assured you, sire, that I could indeed obtain it, and then, not succeeding, I became greatly troubled, not just on account of being deprived of my own space, but also because I suspected you would get upset, sire, believing me to have said one thing and done another, though such deceit was never my intention. Nor did I even want to have this money which was causing me such grief. As it happened, the Mother Abbess was confronted at that point with certain contingencies, which I gladly helped her through, and now she, out of gratitude and kindness, has promised me the room of that nun who is sick, the one whose story I told you, sire, whose room is large and beautiful, and while it is worth 120 scudi, the Mother Abbess will give it to me for 80, thus doing me a particular favor, just as she has on other occasions always favored me. And because she knows full well that I cannot pay a bill of 80 scudi, she offers to reduce the price by the 30 scudi that you gave the convent some time ago, sire, so that with your consent, which I see no reason to doubt, as this seems to me an opportunity not to be missed, I will have all that I could ever want in the way of comfort and satisfaction, which I already know to be of great importance to you. Therefore, I entreat your consideration so that I can give some response to our Mother Abbess, who will be relinquishing her office in a few days and is currently settling her accounts. I also want to know how you feel, sire, now that the air is slightly more serene, and, not having anything better to send you, I offer a little poor man's candied quince, by which I mean that I prepared it with honey instead of sugar. So, if it is not right for you, perhaps it will satisfy the others. I would not know what to give my sister-in-law now, in her condition. Pregnant Cecilia was near term. Surely if she had a taste for anything made by nuns, sire, you would tell us because we want so much to please her. Nor have I forgotten my obligation to La Porzia, Galileo's housekeeper, but circumstances have prevented me from making anything as yet. Meanwhile, if you have gathered the additional clippings you promised me, sire, I will be very happy to receive them, as I am holding off work on those I already have until the others arrive. I must add that, as I write, the sick nun I mentioned earlier has taken such a turn that we think she is on the verge of death, in which event I will be obliged to give the remainder of the money to Madonna right away, so that she can make the necessary purchases for the funeral. In my hands I hold the agate rosary you gave me, sire, which is excessive and vain for me, while it seems perhaps right for my sister-in-law. Let me therefore return it to you, so you can learn if she would like to have it, and in exchange send me a few scudi for my present need, so that, if it please God, I believe I really will have the full sum. And in consequence I will no longer be forced to burden you, sire, for that is what concerns me most. But in fact, I do not have, nor do I want to have, others to whom I can turn, except for you and my most faithful Suor Luisa, who wearies herself doing everything she can for me. But in the end, we depend upon each other, because alone we lack the strength that circumstances so often demand of us. Blessed be the Lord, who never fails to help us. by whose love I pray you, sire, to forgive me if I vex you too much, hoping that God himself will reward you for all the good things you have done for us and continue to do, for which I thank you with all my heart. And I entreat you to excuse me if you find any errors here, because I do not have time to reread this long litany. From San Mateo, the 22nd day of November, 1629, your most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. The rapt repetition of the Franciscan Crown Rosary, the 73 Hail Marys, the 6 Our Fathers, the contemplation of the joyful mysteries required no gilding of agate for a poor Claire. Wooden beads would work just as well, or even chains of dried, hardened rosebuds. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Galileo gave Suor Maria Celeste the money for her need right away. And early in December, Cecilia gave Vincenzo a son, the third and last Galileo Galilei. Chapter 17. While seeking to immortalize your fame. By the time Galileo finished writing his book about the world systems, just as December 1629 drew to a close, he had established a new closeness with his daughter. Ever a source of love and financial aid to Suor Maria Celeste, as well as the grateful recipient of her labors, he now began to do favors for her that required the skilled work of his own hands. And she, emboldened either by her recent assistance on the manuscript for the dialogue, or by the maturity of her nearly 30 years, engaged her father with increased confidence. Before too long, the strength of their mutual affection and deepening interdependence would submit to tests neither one of them could yet imagine. Having moved into her private room, Suor Maria Celeste found it spacious enough to accommodate a small party of sisters at afternoon needlework. The single, small, high window, however, admitted only a dim light, and so she asked Galileo if she might send him the window frames to be refitted with newly waxed linen. "I do not doubt your loving willingness in this matter," she said of her request, "but the fact that the work is rather more suited to a carpenter than a philosopher gives me pause." She also prevailed on him several times to repair the convent's temperamental clock. He fixed it once when its chime failed to wake the sacristan, who in turn failed to summon the other sisters from sleep to the midnight office, and again whenever it developed a different quirk. "Vincenzo worked on our clock for a few days, but since then it sounds worse than ever," she told Galileo on January 21st, 1630. "For my part, I would judge the defect to be in the cord, which, owing to its being old, no longer glides. Still, as I am unable to fix it, I turn it over to you so that you can diagnose its deficiency and repair it. Perhaps the real defect was with me in not knowing the right action to take, which is the reason I have left the counterweights attached this time, suspecting that perhaps they are not in their proper place. In any event, I beseech you to send it back as quickly as you possibly can, because otherwise these nuns will not let me live." Galileo's brother, Michelangelo, had purchased the convent's portable clock, which stood about 2 feet tall, in Germany. Like all mechanical timekeepers of its day, this one offered no precision improvement over the sundial, though it did mark time through the dark or the rain and strike the hour aloud. Italians numbered the hours of the 17th century from 1 to 24, beginning at sunset, so that if Suor Maria Celeste told her father she was writing at the 7th hour, she meant she worked far into the night. And when she reported the death of an ailing nun at the 14th hour of a November Sunday, the time indicated was about 6:30 in the morning. "The clock that traveled back and forth between us so many times now runs beautifully," Suor Maria Celeste said in a thank-you note on February 19th. its flaw having been my fault as I adjusted it improperly. I sent it to you in a covered basket with a towel, and have not seen either of these since. If you find them by chance about your house, sire, please do return them." As he performed these services, Galileo initiated the rigmarole of licensing and printing his recently completed book. Since Prince Chesi of the Lynxian Academy intended to publish the dialogue in Rome, the work would have to undergo censorship there in the Holy City, despite the fact that its author lived in Florence. Galileo, now almost 66, planned personally to deliver the manuscript to the relevant authorities at the Vatican. But Rome was a distant country, and an old man risked his life adding wintry weather to the perils inherent in a 200-mile journey. In February, while Galileo waited for spring, Pope Urban VIII unexpectedly issued a formal salute to his honest life and morals and other praiseworthy merits of uprightness and virtue. With these words, Urban gave Galileo a prebend in Pisa, similar but unrelated to the previously granted canonry at Brescia, which had bounced from Vincenzio to Vincenzio and then out of the Galilei family bounds. Rather than accept the Pisan prebend right away, however, Galileo tried instead to reclaim the Brescian one, now that its incumbent had died, for his infant grandson. "I do not think it would be possible to confer this pension on a baby without a dispensation which will be very difficult to obtain," Galileo's old friend Benedetto Castelli counseled him on the matter. After nearly a year's maneuvering, Galileo himself emerged as Canon of Brescia and Canon of Pisa, with a combined annual annuity of 100 scudi from church revenues. While his clerical posts did not require him to wear a habit or change his lifestyle, he did have his head shaved in an ecclesiastical tonsure by the Bishop of Florence. Mid-March turned Galileo's thoughts toward Rome and his impending departure to procure the printing license for the dialogue. His typical devotion to scholarly pursuits at this point raised the usual concerns in Suor Maria Celeste. "And I would not want you, while seeking to immortalize your fame," she fretted in an April letter, "to cut short your life, a life held in such reverence and treasured so preciously by us, your children, and by me in particular, because, just as I have precedence over the others in years, sire, so too do I dare to claim that I precede and surpass them in my love for you." Galileo gathered the whole family, including Vincenzo and the again pregnant Cestilia, at the convent's parlor grill on the morning of April 15th to say goodbye. By May 3rd, he had arrived at the Tuscan embassy in Rome, where he lodged for the next 2 months as the guest of Ambassador Francesco Nicolini and his charming wife Caterina. Not only did Galileo enjoy their hospitality, but he also prized their connections at the Vatican. Her ladyship, the ambassadress, was a close cousin to the Dominican father Niccolo Riccardi, who controlled the Roman licensing of books. Technically, Pope Urban, as Bishop of Rome, owned this and all other ecclesiastic powers pertaining to the stewardship of the city, but since the Pope's diocese encompassed the world, he delegated most local affairs to his cardinal vicar, and the censorship of books to his master of the sacred palace. Father Riccardi bore this important title, although his cousins at the embassy affectionately called him Father Monster, a nickname he had earned from King Philip III of Spain in recognition of his imposing physical proportions and mental prowess. Galileo could not have handpicked a more favorable judge than Father Riccardi. The man came from a fine Florentine family, closely allied with the Medici, and he had greeted Galileo's previous work, The Assayer, with a gush of admiration. "Besides having found here nothing offensive to morality," Father Riccardi stated in The Assayer's Imprimatur in 1623, "nor anything which departs from the supernatural truth of our faith, I have remarked in it so many fine considerations pertaining to natural philosophy that I believe our age is to be glorified by future ages not only as the heir of works of past philosophers, but as the discoverer of many secrets of nature which they were unable to reveal, thanks to the deep and sound reflections of this author, in whose time I count myself fortunate to be born. When the gold of truth is no longer weighed in bulk and with the steelyard, but is assayed with so delicate a balance. Ambassador Nicolini, nevertheless, took a grim view of the road ahead. He sent word to the Grand Duke in Florence that he expected trouble because of Galileo's numerous, vociferous enemies, particularly among the Jesuits, who were already criticizing both the premise of the new book and its author. Reliable rumors ran through Rome, alleging how the dialogue explained the tides by the motion of the earth. Theologians naturally frowned on such a notion. Father Riccardi read the book himself. He also deputized a fellow Dominican with expertise in mathematics to scrutinize the text and report back to him. Meanwhile, Galileo facilitated a friendship by correspondence between his elder daughter and his kind hostess, Caterina Riccardi Nicolini, for he saw her ladyship the ambassadress as a potential patroness for the Sisters of San Matteo. "The Mother Abbess sends her regards to you, sire," Suor Maria Celeste wrote at the end of May, "and reminds you of what she told you in person, that is, if chance should offer you the opportunity there in Rome to obtain some charitable help for our monastery, to please extend yourself in this effort for the love of God and for our relief. Although I must add that truly it seems an extraordinary thing to ask of people living so far away who, when doing a good deed for someone, would prefer to favor their own neighbors and compatriots. Nonetheless, I know that you know, sire, by biding your time, how to pick the perfect moment for implementing your intentions successfully. And therefore, I eagerly encourage you in this endeavor, because indeed we really are in dire need, and if it were not for the help we have received from several donations of alms, we would be at risk of starving to death." During the 8 weeks Galileo spent in Rome, Pope Urban granted him only one gracious audience. His Holiness had no time for more. The past several years had enmeshed him in difficult papal affairs, including political machinations pertaining to the Thirty Years' War. What had begun as a battle between German Catholics and German Protestants had pulled into its vortex kings and princes of many other countries, including France, Spain, Portugal, Denmark, Sweden, Poland, Transylvania, and Turkey, all contributing to the carnage on German soil. By 1630, only a few of the multiple causes fueling the ongoing fighting still pertained to issues of religious faith. One of these was the struggle between the Catholic royal families of France and Spain for control of the Catholic throne of the Holy Roman Emperor in Germany. The Pope, as the leader of all Catholics everywhere, might have tried harder to unite the Spanish Habsburgs and the French Bourbons. But instead, Urban, who had served early in his church career as papal legate in France, where he held the newborn Louis XIII at the baptismal font, allied himself with King Louis and Cardinal Richelieu. Of late, Urban had grown so fearful of Spanish spies in the Vatican, he complained that he dared not speak above a whisper. The pontiff's war worries so disrupted his sleep that he ordered all the birds in his gardens killed, lest they offend him with nocturnal calls. In addition to the 30 Years' War, Urban entered the War of the Mantuan Succession, which broke out in northern Italy in 1627. In the strategically located Duchy of Mantua in Lombardy, an aged duke and his brother both met their deaths without having produced the obligatory male heir. In 1625, the dying duke had installed a French relative in his Italian office, hoping to keep the property in the family. But a bloody dispute erupted over Mantua that reflected the general tension between France and Spain for an Italian foothold. Urban contributed military support to Mantua and made new enemies among the citizens of Rome by taxing them to help pay the high cost of equipping 7,000 infantrymen and 800 cavalry. Meanwhile, Austrian Habsburg troops, fighting in Mantua, inadvertently released a biological weapon along with their musket fire by carrying the bubonic plague across the Alps into Italy in 1629. Urban, as part of his program to protect the populace from this threat, now traveled clear across Rome every Sunday to say Mass at the Church of Santa Maria Maggiore, where a treasured image of the Madonna had miraculously barred the plague from the city in the 6th century. Adding to Urban's woes, an astrological forecast in the spring of 1630 prophesied his own early demise. The superstitious pontiff retaliated first with imprisonment for the astrologer, and later with a ferocious edict prohibiting predictions of a pope's death, or even the deaths of papal family members up to and including the third degree of consanguinity. Urban's consistent concern for the male members of the Barberini line manifested itself in a perpetual stream of promotions and pensions. The Pope had all but dragged his brother Antonio, a Capuchin monk, away from the simple devotional life at the monastery to become a cardinal in the papal court in 1624. He later made another cardinal of his nephew Antonio in 1628, though the youth, the baby brother of the cardinal nephew Francesco, was only 19. Urban designated the middle child among his three nephews, Taddeo, to father the next generation of Barberinis and married him into a family of landed, titled Roman gentry. Urban had continued all the while to indulge his own intellect by writing and publishing epic poetry. He had also reformed the breviary, the religious order's handbook of prayers, offices, hymns, saints, and instructional passages from the Bible, by adding his own original hymnal compositions in honor of the saints he had canonized. And then, wishing to bring the existing, mostly ancient hymns in the old breviary up to his high standards, Urban had commissioned a cadre of literary Jesuits to edit them for grammar and meter. He had further sought to ensure the immortality of his name through the construction of an ornate bronze canopy above the tomb of St. Peter inside the Vatican Basilica. In 1624, soon after his election, Urban charged the sculptor Gian Lorenzo Bernini to begin building this baldacchino, or arch, over the altar where only the Pope himself was permitted to preside. By the time of Galileo's 1630 visit to Rome, the baldacchino's mammoth form was rising inside the church from four marble cornerstones, each emblazoned on two sides with the Barberini 3B coat of arms. Four support pillars spiraled 95 feet up toward the canopy to be crowned by a cross of gold and a coterie of carved angels. The bronze pillars contained beams lifted from the Pantheon, an enormous ancient structure that had survived the sack of Rome by barbarians in the 5th century. When Urban ordered the venerable Pantheon looted for his armaments and monuments' sake, outraged Romans plaintively played on his name. What the barbarians did not do, they cried, the Barberini did. Everywhere Galileo looked in Rome, he saw evidence of Urban's aggrandizement. Although the Tuscan philosopher remained in the Pope's favor, as the recent prebend and the private audience attested, he could no longer expect the same degree of personal contact that had been his privilege in the past. Galileo saw no reason to feel slighted by this change, however, especially when invited to dine as the special guest of the cardinal nephew, and when told how Father Riccardi was discussing the details of his dialogue in closed session with His Holiness. On June 16th, Galileo found out that the dialogue had passed the reviewer's inspection. Within days, Father Riccardi signed the manuscript, giving Galileo a provisional license to publish in exchange for the promise of a few corrections. The title, for example, displeased the Pope with its allusion to the physical phenomenon of the tides. Galileo had to choose a more mathematical or hypothetical title. Also, the preface and ending must support the Pope's philosophy of science, which attributed all complexity in nature to the mysterious omnipotence of God. In any event, preliminary negotiations with printers regarding the dialogue could now begin. Satisfied, Galileo rushed to leave the city by the end of June, before the plague or malaria wafted into Rome on the summer heat. He promised Father Riccardi he would write the necessary corrections back home at Bello Sguardo and then return with the revised manuscript in autumn. "Had the season been different, I would have stayed to have it printed," he explained later that summer to a correspondent in Genoa, "or else left it in the hands of Prince Cesi, who would take care of it as he has done other works of mine. But he was ill, and what is worse, I now understand he is near death." Indeed, the good Prince Cesi passed away on August 1st, at 45, killed by gangrene of the bladder. His loss all but dissolved the Lynxian Academy. With Cesi gone, Galileo realized he would have to supervise publication of the dialogue himself. And in that case he hoped to avoid trekking back and forth to Rome any longer, but try instead to procure a license from local authorities in Tuscany. Before he could put this plan into effect, however, the deadly plague that had spread through Milan and Turin over the past year moved south to invade the city of Florence. Soon, stricken families on both sides of the Arno mourned new victims of the pestilence at every hour. Up on the hill at Bello Sguardo, one of Galileo's craftsmen, a glassblower, died with his skin discolored by blackish splotches and a putrid bubo festering in his groin. Chapter 18. Since the Lord chastises us with these whips. Most beloved Lord Father, I am heartsick and worried, sire, imagining how disturbed you must be over the sudden death of your poor unfortunate worker. I assume that you will use every possible precaution to protect yourself from the danger, and I fervently urge you to make great effort in this endeavor. I further believe that you possess remedies and preventatives proportionate to the present threat, wherefore I promise not to dwell on the subject. But still, with all due respect and filial confidence, I will exhort you to procure the best remedy of all, which is the grace of blessed God, by means of a thorough contrition and penitence. This, without doubt, is the most efficacious medicine, not only for the soul, but for the body as well, since, given that living happily is so crucial to the avoidance of contagious illness, what greater happiness could one secure in this life than the joy that comes of a clear and calm conscience? It is certain that when we possess this treasure, we will fear neither danger nor death. And since the Lord justly chastises us with these whips, we try, with His aid, to stand ready to receive the blow from that mighty hand which, having magnanimously granted us the present life, retains the power to deprive us of it at any moment and in any manner. Please accept these few words proffered with an overflowing heart, sire, and also be aware of the situation in which, by the Lord's mercy, I find myself, for I am yearning to enter the other life, as every day I see more plainly the vanity and misery of this one. In death I would stop offending, blessed God, and I would hope to be able to pray ever more effectively, sire, for you. I do not know but that this desire of mine may be too selfish. I pray the Lord, who sees everything, to provide through His compassion what I fail to ask in my ignorance, and to grant you, sire, true consolation. All of us here are in good physical health, save for Suor Violante, who is little by little wasting away, although indeed we are burdened by penury and poverty, which take their toll on us, still we are not made to suffer bodily harm with the help of the Lord. I am eager to know if you have had any response from Rome regarding the alms you requested for us. Signor Corso Suor Giulia's brother sent a weight of silk totaling 15 pounds, and Suor Arcangela and I have had our share of it. I am writing at the 7th hour. I shall insist that you excuse me if I make mistakes, sire, because the day does not contain 1 hour of time that is mine, since, in addition to my other duties, I have now been assigned to teach Gregorian chant to 4 young girls, and by Madonna's orders I am responsible for the day-to-day conducting of the choir, which last creates considerable labor for me with my poor grasp of the Latin language. It is certainly true that these exercises are very much to my liking, if only I did not also have to work. Yet from all this I do derive one very good thing, which is that I never, ever sit idle for even 1/4 of an hour, except that I require sufficient sleep to clear my head. if you would teach me the secret you yourself employ, sire, for getting by on so little sleep, I would be most grateful, because in the end the 7 hours that I waste sleeping seem far too many to me. I shall say no more so as not to bore you, adding only that I give you my loving greetings together with our usual friends. From San Mateo, the 18th day of October, 1630. Your most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. The little basket which I sent you recently with several pastries is not mine, and therefore I wish you to return it to me. Suor Maria Celeste's prescription for prayer and penitence in the face of the plague meshed perfectly with prevailing wisdom. Prayer surpassed, or at least augmented, the many available treatments, which included bloodletting, crystals of arsenic applied to the wrists and temples, small sacks of precious stones laid over the heart, and unguents made by cooking animal excrement together with mustard, crushed glass, turpentine, poison ivy, and an onion. The value of confession and penitence reached new heights during plague epidemics, for the disease, once it struck, left its victims no time to make amends. The first symptom typically erupted as a swelling of the lymph nodes under the arms or between the thighs. These large, painful, pus-filled lumps, called buboes, gave the pestilence the name bubonic plague. Ranging in size from almonds to oranges, they were the focus of treatment by doctors, some of whom advocated burning the buboes with incandescent gold or iron, then covering the wound with cabbage leaves. Others preferred to cut the buboes open with a razor, suck out the blood, and deposit 3 leeches on the site, topped by a quartered pigeon or a plucked rooster. Left alone, the buboes enlarged each day until they often burst on their own, provoking agony sufficient to rouse even the nearly dead to frenzy. Since only a fraction of those who contracted the plague could hope to recover, the appearance of the bubo pronounced doom. Fevers rose high within hours of onset, accompanied by vomiting, diffuse pain that felt like burning or prickling, and delirium. Soon the skin displayed weals and dark markings caused by subcutaneous hemorrhage. Death followed within the week, unless the disease also invaded the lungs, where it caused the coughing of a bloody, frothy sputum and killed the victim in 2 or 3 days flat. But not before it facilitated numerous new infections via droplets borne on the wind to be inhaled by the unsuspecting. The plague leaped like fire from the sick to the whole. Even the discarded clothes or other belongings of the afflicted could communicate the disease. When one family member fell sick, the rest typically followed, and soon all were buried in the fields, as the laws of Florence barred plague corpses from the churchyards. The Italian people recognized the plague as an ancient enemy, periodically banished but never vanquished. In its worst visitation, from 1346 through 1349, it claimed 25 million lives, or roughly 1/3 of the population of Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. "Oh, happy posterity," exclaimed poet Francesco Petrarca when that black death robbed him of his beloved Laura, "who will not experience such abysmal woe and will look upon our testimony as a fable." Following the pandemic of the 14th century, the plague returned to one region or another at its own whim every few years, as though to remind the wayward of the tortures of hell. By the early 17th century, Europeans had gained enough experience with the pestilence to recognize the accumulation of dead rats in streets and houses as the harbinger of disease. The causal connection, however, remained elusive. People continued to blame the plague on miasmas of swampy air, the full moon, conjunctions of the planets, famine, fate, beggars, prostitutes, or Jews. 200 years before the germ theory of disease, no one realized that the plague was caused by microbes living in and on the ubiquitous black rats. When a sick rat died, its hungry fleas jumped the few inches to another animal or to a nearby human. Having ingested infected blood, the fleas delivered the disease by inoculation with their next bite. The poisonous plague bacterium multiplied rapidly in a new host's bloodstream until infection pervaded the body, attacking vital organs to cause kidney failure, heart failure, hemorrhaging blood vessels, and death by septic shock. While live rats traveled with impunity on foot and aboard ship, exporting the plague hither and yon, people were confined to their houses by fear and municipal prohibitions. The Venetian Doge imposed the first official quarantine in 1348 after the city death rate from plague had risen to 600 per day. The Doge's council, seeking to isolate returning voyagers from the Orient, had decided on the duration of 40 days, 40 giorni in Italian, from which the word quarantine is derived, by selecting the same period of time that Christ had sequestered himself in the wilderness. When the pestilence returned in 1630, it skirted Venice altogether, dealing its most brutal punishment to the city of Milan and its environs in Lombardy. Nevertheless, the presence of the threat, coupled with the specter of past plagues, mobilized preventive measures all over the peninsula. In Rome, for example, Pope Urban VIII led holy processions and granted indulgences to individuals who followed a formula of church visits, fasting, prayer, the giving of alms, and the taking of communion. He installed his capable nephew, Francesco Cardinal Barberini, as head of the Congregation of Health, which issued policies and edicts to be enforced by civic authorities. Specially appointed guards, stationed at the 12 gates through the city walls, detained all travelers who arrived from plague regions. The plague of 1630 offered the Grand Duke of Tuscany, Ferdinando II, his first chance to assert his new leadership. The 20-year-old Medici scion had only just attained his majority in 1628, at which point he reclaimed the government from his mother, his grandmother, and the Council of Regency. He responded with energy to the present emergency. In addition to all his official acts aimed at contagion control, Ferdinando went out among the people every day to show his compassion, walking the streets through the poorest neighborhoods to dispense comfort and encouragement. The portly Ferdinando looked nothing like a hero. He assumed a suit of armor only to pose for the court portraitist and never wore one into battle. Even on his hunting excursions, he left the bloody work to the falcons. But Ferdinando behaved fearlessly in the face of the plague. In contrast to the many well-to-do Florentines who fled the city in dread, he stood fast throughout the epidemic. He made his four younger brothers stand by him, lending their help, though the Medici family, of course, possessed the means to flee, and many country estates to flee too, some complete with moat and drawbridge. As though rewarded for valor, Ferdinando and his seven siblings all survived the plague in Florence. Ferdinando delegated broad discretionary powers to his public health officers, a group of noblemen who answered directly and only to him. Their ordinances, aimed with good intentions at halting the spread of infection, affected every aspect of daily life. Citizens who resented the policing of their private affairs found ways around the law, and the commissioners found themselves sometimes taunted in the streets, pelted by stones, or formally denounced. For example, the Tuscan clergy, outraged by restrictions on gathering the multitudes together for public sermons and processions, appealed to Pope Urban VIII for redress. The pontiff responded by censuring the whole Board of Health, which included Galileo's friend and former student, Mario Guiducci, so that the board members were forced to perform salutary penance for their good deeds. Hired monitors working for the Florentine Magistracy of Public Health patrolled the city, sending the stricken to the plague hospitals, burning their belongings and disinfecting and boarding up their homes, with the other family members locked inside. Behind these sealed, marked doors, the relatives were expected to wait 22 days for release while subsisting on allotments of bread and money distributed by the magistracy. The confined raised these supplies from the street in baskets on ropes and lowered their corpses from the windows via the same system. Most often the man of the house, at the first hint of the bad disease among the children, would move a mattress and some cooking utensils into his shop, hoping to avoid enclosure and carry on business as usual through the epidemic. When an artisan or apprentice fell sick, his fellow workers might care for him themselves, often breaking the law by failing to report his case and bribing a barber surgeon or an herbalist for secret treatment. though all parties faced strappado torture, being hung by the wrists with hands tied behind their backs, if discovered in such behavior, still they took the risk. Well-meaning weavers, gold-beaters, and butchers managed to foil the magistracy, not just by virtue of their innate cleverness, but because the inadequate army of health deputies could not catch every infraction. Also, the 1,100 health workers, endowed with no special immunity, succumbed to the plague as readily as anyone else, constantly necessitating the appointment of new replacements from the ever-shrinking pool of available able-bodied men. In defiance of the public health edicts, rich and poor alike often tried to hide their sick in the bosom of the family rather than relinquish them to the isolation of the hospital. If a blackened child died at home, at least the intimacy of the tragedy offered its own solace, and held out hope of a finagled death certificate that could convince gravediggers and sacristan to bury the body in a churchyard. A grim new sound insinuated itself into the daily clamor of the city districts, a sound that could still be heard at night when curfews kept the populace indoors. It was the ringing of the bells worn about the ankles of body removers and other sanitary personnel. Meanwhile, the dreaded plague houses at San Miniato and San Francesco took in some 6,000 Florentines who bore buboes or ran suspicious fevers during the autumn of 1630. Most of the patients admitted to these institutions died in them, despite the efforts of resident doctors and clergy, and wound up thrown naked without ceremony into mass graves bordering the city. The magistracy spread lime and erected fences around the graveyards to keep dogs from devouring the cadavers, but the image of some beast bringing home the bones of loved ones, now deceased, became the communal nightmare. Much to Galileo's distress, Vincenzo and the pregnant Cestilia joined the many who sought safety in rural settings, as though the wrath of God would not pursue them beyond the city walls. The couple removed to a villa the Boccineri family owned at Montemurlo in the hinterlands between Prato and Pistoia. Abandoning their house on the Costa San Giorgio, they also left behind their little boy, not yet 1 year old, in the care of a neighborhood wet nurse and his grandfather, Galileo. Chapter 19. The Hope of Having You Always Near. The Sisters of San Mateo survived the autumn of the plague year without a single occurrence of the bad disease within the convent's enclosure. In addition to their prayers, they benefited from the strict precautions spelled out for religious residences by the magistracy of public health. These stipulated, for example, that only the nuns' closest relatives could venture near enough to speak to them, and in any case, the grill had to be covered with a sheet of parchment or paper during all such encounters. "I fear there is no question of your coming here to see us," Suor Maria Celeste wrote to Galileo under the circumstances, "and I do not ask you to visit because none of us could derive much pleasure from it, unable as we are to converse freely just now." For further security, the convent steward and his wife were forbidden to enter any houses in town or even attend Mass at another church without written permission from the Mother Abbess. Incoming letters had to be grasped by forceps and then tanned with acid or bathed in vinegar or held near a flame to purge them of possible contaminants. Any food procured from outside the convent's own kitchen garden had to be purchased early in the morning before it had a chance to be handled by too many shoppers in the marketplace. When the steward took the convent's grain to the mill, he was enjoined to guard it throughout the grinding, making sure that no other grain got mixed in with it and no one else so much as touched it, then collect the finished flour in the same sack he came with and carry it straight back to be baked into bread immediately. None of these measures, nor any of the many other safeguards regarding every detail from the distribution of chaplains' vestments to the laundering of nuns' blankets, would have barred rats from the premises, to be sure, but the sisters' extreme scarcity of food, which reached a critical nadir during the plague, perhaps made the convent walls not worth the bother of breaching. The only death recorded at San Mateo all through 1630 was the late November passing of the long-suffering Suor Violante, whose onset of fever and dysentery predated the plague epidemic by many months. In the outside world, however, the evil pestilence claimed Suor Maria Teodora's brother, Matteo Ninci, a lad loved by all who knew him, and presently Suor Maria Celeste grieved to learn that the plague in Germany had killed her uncle, Michelangelo. Cold, hungry, and surrounded by danger, the nuns appealed for aid from a variety of sources via a letter-writing campaign. Suor Maria Celeste wrote the letters, and Madonna, Madre Caterina Angela Anselmi, the current abbess of San Matteo in Arcetri, signed them. Their supplications began to bear fruit on All Saints' Day, November 1st, when the Dowager Grand Duchess, Madama Cristina, saw an abundance of bread delivered to the convent, followed soon thereafter by 8 bushels of grain, and later by cash contributions from their Serene Highnesses in excess of 200 scudi. The Archbishop of Florence also pledged his aid. He demanded a list of names of the sisters' family members, with an eye toward asking them for financial support through the coming winter time of want. Suor Maria Celeste panicked that such a move would tax Galileo at an unfair rate. Her father already gave generously, and now he would be pressed to pay not only his own share of the archbishop's new demands, but also Vincenzo's and perhaps other relatives as well. Rather than let this happen, she devised a way to restructure the finances of San Matteo so that sums of money long held privately by certain sisters' families and all the interest that had accrued over the years might now be called in to meet the immediate needs of the convent. Since she could not dictate strategy to the archbishop, however, she proposed this idea to Galileo for him to present as his own. "Here I cannot say more," she apologized, "except to call this affair to the attention of the Lord God, and entrust the rest, sire, to your prudence." This course eventually resulted in the desired outcome. To help him in turn, Suor Maria Celeste addressed Galileo's personal and professional disappointments with prayers and exhortations. "I beseech you not to grasp the knife of these current troubles and misfortunes by its sharp edge, lest you let it injure you that way," she wrote in early November, "but rather, seizing it by the blunt side, use it to excise all the imperfections you may recognize in yourself, so that you rise above the obstacles, and in this fashion, just as you penetrated the heavens with the vision of Alinxion, so will you, by piercing also through baser realms, arrive at an awareness of the vanity and fallacy of all earthly things, seeing and touching with your own hands the truth that neither the love of your children, nor pleasures, honors, or riches can confer true contentment, being in themselves ephemeral. But only in blessed God, as in our final destination, can we find real peace. Oh, what joy will then be ours when, rending this fragile veil that impedes us, we revel in the glory of God face to face." Galileo, though frustrated by his continuing inability to publish his dialogue, began to write a new book based on the studies of motion he had begun long ago in Padua. He also kept up his scientific correspondence and consulted regularly on projects for the Grand Duke. In December, for example, Ferdinando asked Galileo to decide which of the two rival engineers' schemes would best keep the Bisenzio River from overflowing its banks, and later bade him advise an architect on plans for repairing the façade of Florence's signature cathedral, Santa Maria del Fiore. "I will go on taking good care of myself, as you urge me to do," Suor Maria Celeste promised her hard-working father. "And how I do desire you to heed some of the same advice you offer me by not immersing yourself so deeply in your studies that you jeopardize your health too markedly. For if your poor body is to serve as an instrument capable of sustaining your zest for understanding and investigating novelties, it is well that you grant it some needed rest, lest it become so depleted as to render even your powerful intellect unable to savor that nourishment it devours with such relish." Suor Maria Celeste further nursed Galileo by plying him with every new plague preventative she could fabricate in her apothecary shop or procure by other means. Although she did not explain how she managed to obtain it, she sent him a bottle of healing water from the venerated Abbess Ursula of Pistoia, a liqueur which Ursula's own followers placed on a par with holy relics and dared not distribute to outsiders. "Therefore I urge you, sire, to put your faith in this remedy, because if you believe as strongly as you have indicated in my poor prayers, then all the more greatly can you trust in a soul so saintly, assuring yourself that by her merits you will escape every danger." She could not similarly endorse another offering, an electuary of dried figs, nuts, rue leaves, and salt, held together with as much honey as was needed, but still she prepared it for him, pressed it on him, and prescribed its usage. You may take it every morning, before eating, in a dose about the size of a walnut, followed immediately by drinking a little Greek or other good wine, and they say it provides a marvelous defense. Indeed, this formula carried the official endorsement of the Magistracy of Public Health. Galileo reciprocated with periodic gifts of money and food, including meats, sweets, and even a special spinach dish he cooked himself especially for her, as well as by giving her a warm quilt to replace the one she had yielded to Suor Arcangela, miscellaneous containers and glass vials for her apothecary work, and citrons that she returned to him as quickly as she could, candied to his liking. When he forgot to send a promised telescope, she reminded him to put it in the basket next time. This gentle reprimand, her only surviving mention of any scientific instrument, hints that she may have borrowed a peek at the moons of Jupiter or the horns of Venus, despite the duties that ate up all her time. Galileo apparently accompanied the tokens of his paternal love with frank praise for her abilities, though she deflected these compliments. "I am confounded to hear that you save my letters," she remarked, "and I suspect that the great love you bear me makes them seem more accomplished than they really are." In December 1630, the Tramontana, the cold wind from the Apennines, beat into Tuscany with force, effectively locking Galileo indoors. Unable to visit the convent as he had wished, he sent news of his health via his new housekeeper, La Piera, whose prudence and capability impressed Suor Maria Celeste. Now she calmed herself to think that her father was well looked after, even if the attention came from a hired employee instead of her brother's family. Suor Maria Celeste had disapproved of Vincenzo's flight, but held her tongue for fear he would leave anyway and that her intrusion would only upset him. Now she worried what might happen to her brother's empty, unguarded house in his absence. At the same time, she encouraged Galileo to continue to play the generous father, especially in perpetuating your beneficence toward those who repay you with ingratitude, for truly this action, being so rife with difficulty, is all the more perfect and virtuous. In early January, the magistracy sent out nuncios and trumpeters to declare a general quarantine of 40 days' duration, beginning on the 10th of the month. Sensing a decline in the epidemic's virulence, the authorities hoped to hasten it to its end by this drastic measure. The imposition of the general quarantine limited travel in or out of the city even more strictly than before, and also forbade ordinary household visits among neighbors and friends. The only permissible reasons for venturing out of one's doors now were to go to church or to buy food or medicines. Since the ordinance applied to Florence and all its surrounding communities, including Prato, Vincenzo could not have returned easily during these 6 weeks, even if he had wanted to. Vincenzo's new baby, Carlo, arrived on January 20th, but Galileo did not hear a timely announcement of the birth or any word at all from his absent son and daughter-in-law regarding their welfare in this time of constant sorrow. Suor Maria Celeste's concern naturally stayed focused on the firstborn, nicknamed Galileino, who had been introduced to his aunt and cousin at the convent in his infancy. Now she repeatedly asked her father to bring the boy back to visit her again as soon as it was safe to do so. "I want you to give one more kiss," she would say in closing a letter, "to Galileino for my love." And she sent him pine cones to play with, expecting he could amuse himself extracting the nuts. She baked little cookies for the other child now in Galileo's care, his grandniece Virginia, the daughter of Vincenzo Landucci, and his sickly wife, but Suor Maria Celeste could not help her father place La Virginia at San Mateo. "I am terribly disturbed by my inability to grant you satisfaction as I would have liked to do in taking custody here of La Virginia, for whom I feel such fondness, considering all the sweet relief and diversion she has been to you, sire. However, I know that our superiors have declared themselves totally opposed to our admitting young girls, either as nuns or as charges, because the extreme poverty of our convent, with which you are well acquainted, sire, makes it a struggle to sustain those of us who are already here, let alone consider the addition of new mouths to feed." with her sister-in-law Cecilia in hiding at Montemurlo and still incommunicado after the quarantine ended, Suor Maria Celeste resumed the upkeep of Galileo's wardrobe. I am returning the bleached collars, which, on account of their being so frayed, refused to turn out as exquisitely as I would have wished. If you need anything else, please remember that nothing in the world brings me greater joy than serving you, just as you, for your part, seem to devote yourself to doting on me and satisfying any request, since you provide for my every need with such solicitude. If her claustration posed no impediment to their emotional closeness, the distance between Bello Sguardo and Arcetri now raised a formidable barrier. I find my thoughts stay fixed on you day and night, and many times I regret the great remove that bars me from being able to hear daily news of you as I would so desire. Galileo suffered this same lonely longing. The prospect of the mule trek from his house to her convent, though it hadn't seemed so lengthy or arduous at first, of late, too